Imagine being so involved in the act of murder that it no longer held any emotion for you. No shame, guilt, pleasure, or pain. The same emotion one may have eating an apple was the same feeling that Donald Henry Gaskins felt when taking a life. And many lives he did take. Today, part two of the Donald Henry Gaskins story on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
Part 2. The Fugitive. Whatever Gaskins may have learned from his prison college education, it did not include a course on staying out of trouble. Reunited briefly with his mother and stepfather, he returned to work in the tobacco sheds until an argument with his stepfather came to blows and Gaskins threatened the older man's life with a pitchfork. From there, he moved in with a cousin and resumed stripping cars, soon reverting to his old pattern of residential burglaries, looking for cheap sex in honky-tonk bars. Late in 1961, Gaskins had a near-miss brush with salvation. He went to work for circuit-riding preacher George Todd, driving the minister's van and serving as his general assistant. But the gospel had no impact on Pee-wee. Instead, he seized the opportunity to loot homes while they traveled, selling off whatever he could steal to willing buyers on the road. Along the way in 1962, he met wife number three, a 17-year-old who caught his eye despite the fact that she was old by my standards. Marriage, like religion, failed to civilize Gaskins. During his second year with Reverend Todd, he was jailed for statutory rape of a 12-year-old girl in Florence County. Taken to the courthouse for arraignment, Gaskins slipped out a window, stole a county car, and fled to Greensboro, North Carolina. There he soon met and married wife number four, another 17-year-old, and abandoned her after 3 months. "It weren't that I stopped loving her," he later wrote. "It were the edginess and bothersomeness stirring around inside me. I got so edgy and mad at the world, I just had to get away." As for his many wives, Pee-wee maintained, "I truly love them all." Briefly reunited with his third wife in Georgia, Gaskins was en route to Florida when a highway patrolman tried to stop him for speeding. Fearing arrest as a fugitive, Gaskins drove his car into a swamp and escaped on foot, leaving his not-so-ex-wife to the law. From there, he returned to North Carolina and wife number four, but she blew the whistle on him and he was extradited for trial. Jurors in Florence County rejected Pee-wee's argument that sex with preteen girls was justifiable. Convicted in 1964, he got 6 years for statutory rape and two more for his flight from custody. The state pen in Columbia had been renamed the Central Correctional Institute in Gaskins' absence, but nothing else had changed. He brought his reputation with him and did easy time as a power man, paroled in November 1968 on the condition that he stay out of Florence County for 2 years. Upon release, Pee-wee later said, "I was damn determined I never was going back to prison, which didn't mean I wasn't ever going to do anything illegal again. I just wasn't never planning on getting caught." That meant Gaskins rid of witnesses, and Gaskins reckoned he was equal to the task. And in the process, he would have some fun. So, it's the dark side of Wikipedia. It's Donald Henry Gaskins Part 2. And if you like our program, you want to hear the final chapter of this episode, as well as all of our other episodes and get advanced episodes, all of that, go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia. Sign up, $5 a month gets you access to all of the extras, and it's what allows us to keep doing this show. It's Tony and Sean with you on today's episode. An observation on the world of the 50s and the 60s, kind of where this story takes place. A lot of people look back on kind of that time window, maybe not necessarily the 60s, but, you know, there's a lot of you know, I guess objectifying, I mean, object, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is here, but looking at that window in time is, oh, the good old days and this or that, even though there was plenty of horrible shit going on in our world that was completely not good old days. But I also look to it like sentencing of criminals for shit like raping a 12-year-old girl. And arguing it in court and fleeing authorities over state lines. And you only get 6 fucking years for that? In the good old days? In good old times when people had better values in this shit? I don't fucking think... Like, did we really have better values, or did everybody just look the other way on all the horrible fucking people that were out there?
Tell you what, that's old Pee-wee Gaskins. Now, we're getting the Johnson boy. Well, shit, he's got a life sentence for running moonshine through the night over to the Miller girls, and she's allergic to alcohol. So, the Johnson boy, by getting her moonshine, she almost died.
He raped her, and she was 8.
Now, Pee-wee Gaskins, he only played a little game of non-consensual kickball. Come on now. You remember growing up when you had your Skip It, because, you know, you had your Skip It because you wanted a Nintendo for Christmas, but you got the Skip It. Well, hell, he just raped her. Yeah, that's, it's very interesting. Well, what I would like to think is, as much as we believe the justice system is absolutely fucked current day, I believe there is a little bit more accountability. There's a little bit more warrants, evidence, surveillance, etc., than maybe there was back in the good old days. And again, here in 2021, and as we know, and as we, I mean, you and I, 30 years ago, we speak of prior episodes and Jeffrey Dahmer. Well, we're kids back then. Yeah. We don't know how things come to be. But as current day adults, we do see that there is a certain level of still cluster fuckery. But you have to look back when this is happening, and looking at it from what we know and current standards of evidence and such, and absolute heinous crimes of how long you should be locked up, we don't know what there was back then as far as, which you'd like to think, I don't give a shit if it's 1930 or 2021 or 1800. If you do something to children, we're going to take a battery and jumper cables and do bad things. But I don't know. It's it makes no sense, but maybe it made a little bit more sense back then.
I don't
believe so.
The thing, I mean, women's rights were so shitty back then too. And, you know, we're not talking that long ago. And, but they were coming, you know, it was just starting to enter a world of women's liberation. You go to the 50s and you go 40s, you're talking the Mad Men era. So you had, you know, probably the seriousness of it looked at as they just didn't take it seriously. And that's what's so angering and fucked up when you hear the good old days. It was good if you were an old white guy. And I think that's what so many people hold on to. And I'm not saying white guys or old white guys are inherently bad. I'm saying the ones that are selfish and narcissistic and just don't give a fuck about anybody but themselves, those are bad fucking people. And you could really be any race, any color, any age and have those characteristics. But there was, you cannot deny it, in that era of time of the good old days, an overabundance of that. And I don't care. I mean, it's just fucked up. I mean, I know it's like, well, it was a different time. Then go against the fucking grain and say, look, maybe this was fucking wrong. And thank goodness enough people have done that over time, but we're still not there. But it's just, I don't know. It's fucked up when I look at it.
There's really nothing of sense to make in this, aside from this gentleman seemed to be kind of a salesman.
Yeah.
And he got himself out of a lot of sticky situations to cover up his desire to do absolutely sadistic things. But when he found himself in a position, you remember, what is it, Vacation? Hey, look, kids, or Christmas Vacation, look, kids, a deer. And then he flips off the passerby on the interstate. This guy was very good at, don't look at all these bad things that it did. I'm just old Pee-wee. Want to sell you a used Corolla?
Yeah.
And just give me 6 years and I'm out.
He may talk like a yokel, but I think he's probably a lot smarter than what he portrays. I think a lot of it's an act. because you'd have to be very intelligent to continue to pull off this shit over and over and over and not end up incarcerated forever, unless the judicial system was really just that fucked up and just kind of kept letting him go, which it did seem to do quite a bit of. Let's continue into the story as we go into the Coastal Kills section of Donnie's life here on the dark side of Wikipedia. Gaskin settles in Sumner, North Carolina, or South Carolina, working construction and stripping hot cars on weekends, cruising bars for sex. He still suffered them aggravated and bothersome feelings, now accompanied by headaches, stomach cramps, and pain in his groin. Increasingly, he brooded over women who rejected him. He drove compulsively along the Carolina coast, later recalling, "It was like I was looking for something special on them coastal highways, only I didn't know what." In September 1969, he found out. The hitchhiker was young and blonde, bound for Charleston, thumbing rides outside Myrtle Beach. Gaskins picked her up and propositioned her. When she laughed in his face, he beat her unconscious and drove to an old logging road. There, he raped and sodomized his victim, then tortured and mutilated her with a knife. She still clung to life when he weighted her body and sank her in the swamp to drown. Leaving the scene, Gaskins recalled, "I felt truly the best I ever remembered feeling in my whole life." Gaskins later called that first impulsive homicide his miracle, a beam of light, like a vision. From that day on, he made a habit of trolling the coastal highways on weekends, seeking victims and exploring future dump sites. By Christmas 1969, he committed two more coastal kills, one where I didn't know the victims or their names or nothing about them. It was recreational murder, refined over time until he could keep his victims alive and screaming for hours on end, sometimes for days. In 1970, Gaskins averaged one coastal kill every 6 weeks, experimenting with different torture methods, disappointed when his victims died prematurely. "I preferred them to last as long as possible," he wrote. The next year, Pee-wee claimed 11 nameless victims, including his first kidnap slaying of two girls at once. Ideas for tormenting his captives came to Gaskins as he browsed through hardware stores, eyeing the tools. "I never gave no thought to stopping," he admitted. "They was a clock kind of thing. When it was time, I went and killed." His first male victims were acquired by accident, two long-haired boys whom Gaskins took for girls as he drove up behind them in March of 1974. Gedner would not save them, though. Gaskins wrote them both to a hideout near Charleston, where he sodomized and tortured both, cooking and cannibalizing their severed genitals before he granted them the mercy of death. Gaskins lost track of the victims he murdered for sport between September of 69 and December 1975. "They were hard to recall," he explained, "because they're just mostly a jumble of faces and bodies and memories of things I did to them. In terms of numbers," he said, "the closest figure I can come to is maybe 80 to 90. Sadistic murder was addictive for Pee-wee. I finally reached the point where I wanted the bothersomeness to start," he wrote. "I look forward to it every month because it felt so good relieving myself of it." The only coastal victim he recalled by name was a 16-year-old Ann Culberson, picked up near Myrtle Beach in 1971. Gaskins was not hunting at the time, but he refused to miss a golden opportunity. Over 4 days of rape and torture, he became real fond of her, finally because she had been so nice to me. Gaskins stunned her with a hammer and cut her throat before dropping Culberson into quicksand. The coastal kills were always recreation, though. However atrocious their suffering, they meant nothing to Gaskins. The focus of his life lay inland, where murder and business mixed. Before 1970, despite sporadic incidents of violence with family and friends, Gaskins maintained that he never gave any real serious thought whatsoever to killing a personal acquaintance. "The most important thing about 1970, he wrote from prison, "was that it was the year I started doing my serious murders, defined as slayings of persons he knew whose deaths require more planning to avoid detection." His first two serious victims were a 15-year-old niece, Janice Kirby, and her 17-year-old friend, Patricia Alsobrook. Gaskins also entertained thoughts of raping Kirby, but saw no opportunity until one night in November 1970, when the girls were out drinking, in need of a ride home. Gaskins volunteered, taking them instead to an abandoned house where he ordered them both to strip. The girls fought for their lives, clubbing Gaskins with a board before he drew a gun and overpowered them and beat them unconscious. After raping both, he drowned the girls and buried them in separate locations. Police grilled Pee-wee about the double disappearance, and while he admitted taking the girls on at least on the last night they were seen alive, he claimed they had left him and driven off in a car with several unknown boys. Lacking a corpse or other evidence, the trial went cold. A month later, Gaskins kidnapped, raped, and murdered Peggy Catino, a 13-year-old daughter of a politically prominent family. This time, he left the body where it would be found. His alibi looked solid when police came calling, and they later focused on another suspect, William Pierce, already serving life in Georgia for a similar offense. Conviction of Catino's murder bought Pierce his second life sentence, a moot point since Georgia had no intention of releasing him. Years later, when Gaskins later confessed to the murder, embarrassed prosecutors rejected his statement, insisting Pee-wee claimed the murder for publicity. Gaskins interrupted the murder spree to marry his pregnant girlfriend in January 1st of 1971, but it was only a momentary distraction. His next serious murder victim, and the first African-American he ever killed, was 20-year-old Martha Dix, a hanger-on around the garage where Gaskins worked part-time. For reasons best known to herself, Dick seemed infatuated with Gaskins, boasting falsely to friends that they were lovers. Gaskins tolerated the jokes until Dix claimed to be carrying his child. Inviting her to stay on one night, after work, he fed Dix a fatal overdose of pills and liquor, discarding her corpse in a roadside ditch. Rumors of sex and racism aside, Gaskins insisted, "I didn't kill her for no reason besides her lying mouth." In late 1971, Gaskins moves to Charleston with his wife and child, committing his next two serious murders there in 1972. The victims were Eddie Brown, a 24-year-old gun runner, and his wife, Bertie, described by Gaskins as the best-looking black girl I ever saw. Gaskins sold guns to Brown, including stolen military weapons, but he grew nervous when Brown informed him that a federal agents were sniffing around Charleston seeking illicit arms dealers. Fearing a setup, Gaskins shot the Browns and planted them behind a barn where he had buried Janice Kirby in 1970. Gaskins moved to Prospect, South Carolina in July of 1973 after his Charleston home burned down. He blamed arsonists for the fire but never identified the culprits. Before year's end, he murdered three more victims, starting with 14-year-old runaway Jackie Freeman. Gaskins picked her up hitchhiking in October and held her captive for 2 days of rape, torture, and cannibalism. "I always thought of Jackie as special," he recalled in his memoirs. "Not really a serious murder, but likewise not just another coastal kill." The weekend after Freeman slaying, Gaskins bought a used hearse and put a sign in the window, "We haul anything living or dead." When asked about it over drinks, he explained that he wanted the vehicle because I kill so many people, I need a hearse to haul them to my private cemetery. His first passengers are 23-year-old Doreen Dempsey and her 2-year-old daughter, Robin Michelle. Gaskins knew Dempsey from his carny days. An unwed mother pregnant with her second child in December of 1973, she planned on leaving town that month and accepted Pee-wee's offer of a drive to the local bus station. And said he drove her into the woods where he demanded sex. Doreen agreed, then balked when Gaskins started to undress her child. Gaskins killed Doreen with a hammer, then raped and sodomized the child before strangling her to death and burying both victims together. Years later, he would recall his brutal assault on Robin and Michelle as the best sex of his life. Pee-wee's serious murders continued in 1974, beginning with 36-year-old car thief Johnny Sellers. Sellers owed Gaskins $1,000 for auto parts, but he was also slow to pay. Finally, tired of excuses, Gaskins lured Sellers to the woods and shot him with a rifle. Later the same night, hoping to forestall investigation of Sellers' disappearance, Gaskins called on Johnny's girlfriend, 22-year-old Jessie Ruth Judy, and stabbed her to death, hauling her corpse to the forest for burial beside her lover. Horace Jones, another car thief and con man, made a fatal mistake of trying to romance Pee-wee's current wife in 1974. "That pissed me off," Gaskins recalled in Final Truth. "Not the attempt per se, but the way he went about doing it. I meant if he had come straight to me like a man and asked to make a deal with me for my wife, I'd probably have given him to her for a night or a week or to keep if the offer was good enough." As it was, he shot Jones in the woods and stole $200 from the corpse before leaving Jones in a shallow grave. Searchers identified the gravesite eventually. Wow, this guy's like, I don't know, how the fuck does he do all this? How do you get away with this level of all these things? Because he doesn't, I mean, he seems a little, you know, kind of sloppy. I know there wasn't DNA evidence and shit like that back then, but couldn't you kind of connect some dots here just by the circle that he had that was kind of being murdered?
Here's the thing. We all get our cravings. And for me personally, it's pizza. Sometimes it's ice cream. Maybe if I'm, you know, really craving, maybe some gelato. For old Pee-wee, his niece. That is, and again, in all these interesting characters that we meet, at the heart and the origin of their absolute misery is an addiction, is something is off. And if you just go to any old place and kill random people, well, yeah, I'm sure that's fun. But then you want to top it. You want to have some more emotional tie. You want to know the person. You want to be, I don't know, related to the person. That is, is it weird that as we get to know more and more about these murderers and such, that there's all seems to be a common theme where they almost want to top their, how fucked up can I be? I've done that 20 times. Let's try this.
They do. I mean,
and it all is like a common occurrence. They've done, you know, kind of just random people, which, by the way, as a parent and your son has longer hair, don't have him listen to this. Probably not. But if he needs another reason to cut his hair, he'll be confused as a girl and be killed. Cut your hair, son. So the pandemic is almost over. So, yeah, it's just they do something. They get into a flow. They stop for a little bit. And then they come back with a vengeance and try to up the ante, if you will.
The amount of people that he killed and literally confesses to, writes a fucking memoir. How is it that our system didn't kill him before he can get the book out? You know, it's like he confessed to all these things. He's clearly the person who did all these things. But yet we sit on the sidelines going, okay, well, we got him arrested now. Let's figure this out. Like, what the fuck? At what point can we just be like, kill the motherfucker? Why are we going to let him write a goddamn book? Like, what? Where? What the fuck? I don't know. I'm not like a proponent that runs around all the time going pro death penalty and shit. But the more we do this show and the more I hear these stories of these people, the more it's like, wipe them off the face of the earth the moment you realize or they confess that you've got the right fucking person.
I am not a big person when it comes to conspiracy theories. But in some of these situations, you have to ask yourself, is there some type of tie-in of the judge or prosecutor or defense lawyer with the actual suspect?
Yeah.
Where do you guys have something, speaking of moonshine, do you have some truck that you're going to cross some county line that, and this is obviously some of the older stories that we talk about, the early 1900s, but the only thing that makes sense is they are in cahoots in some way, shape, or form. Because anybody with half a brain in that type of role, how do you let this person walk? How do you let this person have such a short prison sentence if you are not in some way, shape, or form affiliated or there's some backdoor agreement?
I don't know. I mean, it literally, you know, he's getting into close to the hundreds of deaths. I mean, if this were like a war situation and it's like some ringleader of some, you know, Al-Qaeda or something, and they're targeting him, fuck, if he's in another country, we would just go in and fucking take him out. It's because he's a U.S. citizen and doing all this shit to other people. It's like, well, we got to go and do our process. It's like, well, you already know he's the guy. You know he's the fucking guy. I don't know. I'm just, I think I would not make a good police officer or SWAT member or whatever when you're like doing the raid on somebody like that, especially if you know their whole fucking story.
And Hold on, need a warrant.
And if you know that it's like, well, we want to get him. And you know the court system is just going to let him live out his days. I think it'd be really hard not to pull the trigger on him and be like, he pulled a gun or he threatened me. So it was that was needed on somebody like that. I don't know how you really, you know, I don't know. I just don't know. They baffle me.
So you're saying that you could kill a person.
Somebody like this. Yes, without a doubt. Yeah. As long as I knew that this was the person, I wouldn't do if there was any question. But if I knew this was the guy, or if this guy had done this to my child or something, fuck, I'd be finding a way to stake out that prison and somehow get in there and, you know, get behind those bars to take him out. If it were that close, I'd no fucking problem with that whatsoever. I think sometimes as secure those prisons are, it's half of it is to keep the non-prisoners away from the prisoners for some of these crimes, because I'm sure there's many a dads in this story that would have loved to have gotten behind those bars for a few minutes with Donald Henry. Consequences be fucking damned. You know, I don't know how you do it. Figure that out. Like, oh, I'm just here. You pretend you're a minister. You go, I'm here to preach and we're going to sit. Can we sit down and have some coffee together, me and Donnie? And then, you know, you pull the crucifix out and it's a fucking knife. I think that's how I do it. I'd be the exorcist killer.
Coming up on the Hallmark Channel this week, a real family favorite.
Looks like Danny Tanner coming in to preach, and it's you're there to kill the serial killer that killed your family. I think that's what I would do.
Oh, such heartwarming family.
There you go.
Episode.
I watch too much true crime shit. It's like, how would you do it if the serial killer went after you? This is how I'd do it. All right, let's continue in with the story. By December of 1974, Gaskins was a grandfather, settled into a routine that suited him and satisfied his needs. The Christmas season, he recalled, was the happiest and peacefulest I can remember. Pee-wee didn't know it yet, but he was running out of time. Writing from prison, Gaskins called 1975 my busiest year and my killingest year. His pace of random murders on the Carolina coast remained about the same, although he started January with a threesome, including a man and two women. Gaskins described them as hippie types from Oregon whose van had broken down near Georgetown. He offered a lift to the nearest garage, then detoured to a nearby swamp and handcuffed his captives at gunpoint. Before he drowned the trio, Gaskins said it was hard to say which one suffered most. I tried to make it equal. Gaskins made a critical mistake when he recruited ex-con Walter Neely to help him dispose of the van. Neely drove the vehicle to Pee-wee's garage, where Gaskins customized and repainted it for sale out of state. The drive made Neely an accessory after the fact, and Gaskins trusted his simple-minded helper to keep a secret. Before year's end, he would regret that choice. Pee-wee's first serious murder of the year involved a contract to kill Silas Yates, a wealthy Florence County farmer. He accepted $1,500 for the job on behalf of 27-year-old Suzanne Kipper, furious at Yates for taking back a car, two horses, and other gifts he had given her while they were romantically involved. Two go-betweens on the contract, John Powell and John Owens, handled negotiations between Gaskins and Kipper. Gaskins recruited Diane Neely, friend Walter X's wife, to lure Yates from home on the night of February 12, 1975, claiming her car had broken down near his house. Pee-wee waited in the darkness to abduct Yates at gunpoint and drive him to the woods, where Powell and Owens watched him knife Yates to death. Then, help Gaskins bury the corpse. Kipper subsequently married Owens, while Pee-wee used his knowledge of the murder to blackmail her for sex on demand. The contracts came back to haunt Gaskins when Diane Neely moved in with Avery Howard, a 35-year-old ex-convict whom Gaskins knew from state prison. She told Howard about the murder, and together they approached Gaskins with a demand for $5,000 hush money. Gaskins agreed to meet them in the woods outside Prospect and bring the cash. The blackmailers arrived to find an open grave and Gaskins with a pistol in his hand. Two shots, a bit of a spade work, and Pee-wee reckoned his problem was solved. The human juggernaut rolled on. Kim Gelkins was the next to die, a 13-year-old friend of Gaskins who angered him by rejecting his sexual overtures. Pee-wee reacted in typical style by raping, torturing, and strangling her, planting her body in the woods. Diane Neely's brother, 25-year-old Dennis Bellamy, teamed with 15-year-old half-brother Johnny Knight to loot Pee-wee's chop shop that summer, thus earning themselves a death sentence. Gaskins took Walter Neely along to help bury the pair in his private cemetery, taking time to point out the surrounding graves of Johnny Sellers, Jesse Judy, Avery Howard, and Walter's ex-wife. Again, for reasons never clear, he trusted Neely and allowed him to survive. By October 1975, Kim Gelkin's parents knew enough of her movements to suspect Gaskins of murder. A Sumter deputy sheriff searched Pee-wee's home and found some of Kim's clothes in his closet, afterwards securing statements that she was often seen in his company. The evidence would not support a murder charge, but Gaskins was indicted for contributing to the delinquency of a minor. He returned from Georgia on November 14, 1975, to find police staked out around his house. Gaskins dodged them and made his way to a local bus station, planning a return to Georgia, but officers nabbed him before he could leave. Unable to post bond, Gaskins sat in jail for 3 weeks before the storm broke. Walter Neely had crumbled, telling all the police on advice from a neighboring minister. He led authorities to Pee-wee's graveyard, where victims Bellamy and Knight were unearthed on December 4th. A day later, diggers found the bodies of Sellers, Judy Howard, and Diane Neely. On December 10th, Walter led them to the graves of Doreen Dempsey and her child. Gaskins struck a pose of injured innocence, but all in vain. Looking back on that chaotic month, he would recall, "The coroner had the bodies, Jesus had Walter, and the law had me." Following a Florence County coroner's inquest on April 27th, of 1976, Gaskins and Walter Neely were each charged with 8 counts of first-degree murder. Police also detained James Judy, husband of the murdered Jesse, on 1 count of murder and an accessory charge. Prosecutor T. Kenneth Sumford arranged for Gaskins to be tried alone in the Bellamy case. Since bullets from the victim's body matched a pistol Gaskins had carrying on him in his arrest in 1975. At trial, the trial convened on May 24, 1976. Gaskin feigned innocence, blaming Bellamy's murder on Walter Neely. Bellamy and Johnny Knight were both alive at the time he last saw them. Gaskins testified, leaving his garage with Neely. For all he knew, Walter had stolen his pistol to murder the men, then replaced it without Pee-wee's knowledge. Jurors dismissed the fable and convicted him on May 28th, whereupon Judge Dan McEachin sentenced Gaskins to die. The verdict frightened James Judy, wholly innocent of his wife's murder, into angling for a plea bargain. Police thought he had hired Gaskins to kill his wife and Johnny Sellers out of jealousy, and if a jury felt likewise, he might be sent to the electric chair. Panicked, Judy pled guilty in return for a life sentence and went off to serve his time. Walter Neely was next, tried on 8 counts of murder, his attorneys calling him a mentally retarded dupe who bowed to Pee-wee Gaskins' every whim. In a way, Gaskins later wrote, "I reckon that was true, too. Walter surely weren't real bright, and he did pretty much anything I asked him up until he got born again and forgot all about what loyalty and friendship meant." Convicted on all counts, Neely still evoked sufficient pathos to escape with a single life sentence. Pee-wee's attorney urged him to cut a deal with prosecutors to avoid another death sentence on his 7 pending murder charges. Gaskins agreed, confessing to the crimes and adding details under influence of truth serum, but he could have saved the effort. So there is certainly more to the story, and we'll get into that in the final chapter of what happens to good old Donald Henry Gaskins. But my God, gets caught. And I guess the downfall is he started trying to kind of create a little group to help carry out his murders.
I mean, if you're good at it, you obviously want to train others. You can you can grow. You're a business owner. You know how that works.
Trying to franchise out his murdering.
I thought we were kind of at the at the max of trying to understand this fella, and then he goes and I'm a bit baffled, old Pee-wee.
But hey, and the funny part is, because we're talking 1976 here when the sentencing and stuff goes on, just a few short, about 10 years later, the character Pee-wee Herman is introduced to children everywhere. It's kind of an interesting name to pick for the children character after all this.
And this is 10 years. So you look at it, 2011, if there is somebody that is convicted in 2011 that killed upwards of 90 people who had a interesting nickname, would you come up with a child's character to exactly. have their name as such?
Yeah, I mean, if there was like a killer that did all,
hey kids,
all
Saturday
of this
morning
shit.
On ABC, our friend and yours, OJ.
You wouldn't even do that.
No. And he lives in a cold climate up in Canada where he always wears gloves. But the gloves don't seem to fit.
OJ in the morning. Yeah, I mean, it would do. It's.
And his old friend, Andy the Bronco. He rides in that Bronco every day on that Bronco. Not in that Bronco, my bad. And he's a white horse. It's a white Bronco.
Yeah, it's. I don't think it would fly today. And I don't know what the public just not in tune with everything going on or what the fuck. I don't know.
Well, I believe, and this is a whole different topic, but just a short version of it. It wouldn't fly today because there are about a million things that at 2 years ago could fly that couldn't fly today.
Yeah.
We are in such a current, and it has, I'm not getting into this discussion, but as a whole, I believe we can collectively agree that it has never been more sensitive of observing anything and everything in this time if you're wanting to start something new. And what you call it and how you,
sure.
It's just a very, very sensitive time for good reason. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's just, there's a lot of things that, you know, let alone 10 years ago, 2 years ago, a year ago that could start or happen that can't today.
And I also think, I don't know that you could have a killer like this today and have pulled off all of these crimes in this fashion, because all these people today would have cell phones. All these, you know, I don't think you could do a crime spree like this. I think the lack of technology allowed it to happen. And I just think today there would be so many quicker ways of honing in on who's doing this. He could start the spree, but I don't think he could get to the level that he did for the years that he did today, at least in any modern country where people are as connected as they are. You know, one of the 100 people will be fucking live streaming the shit. And then, oh my God, what's, you know, it would have been figured out rather quickly. So that's a way, as much as people like to curse technology, I think it prevents these people from living or from carrying out their shit. And, you know, maybe they're just doing it now when they're playing Grand Theft Auto versus actually doing it in real life. There's a final chapter to the Donald Henry Gaskin story. We're going to get into that next on our final chapter segment over on Patreon. If you want to hear it and get access to all of our final chapters and advanced episodes of the show, all of it commercial free, the whole archive's there for you as well. Go to patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia. That's patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia and click become a darksider. Get access to all of our stuff and help keep us on the air. We'll see you over there on the final chapter on the Donald Henry Gaskin story with the Dark Side of Wikipedia. Wikipedia.